As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Arden Zwelling and Dave Zerum of Sportsnet Magazine. Lots to get to today. Steve Nash looks like his career is done. NBA season getting cranked up for the Raptors on Wednesday. Home tilt against the Atlanta Hawks. We'll talk about World Series. Back in control of the Kansas City Royals. Joe Maddon also kind of sudden departure from the Tampa Bay Rays. And we will talk a whole bunch of hockey. The Maple Leafs had their game postponed, naturally, in Ottawa against the Senators on Wednesday. I think everybody agrees that the National Hockey League did the correct thing in postponing that game. It's going to be made up just before Remembrance Day, which is going to be a perfect time for it. But Maple Leafs back in action tonight at home against the Boston Bruins. All of a sudden, the Bruins in a whole heap of trouble. They haven't gotten off to much of a start at all. 4-5-0, 8 points through their 9 games, most games played in the Eastern Conference. And now Zdeno Chara out for a whole heap of time. But the Maple Leafs look okay. I mean, this has been kind of an up-and-down season already for them, and they are just 7 games in. Arden, I know you're writing a story on Jonathan Bernier. The goaltending has been kind of the interesting thing about this team through 7 games of this regular season.
I guess so. Yeah, it became a story like right away. Like, I don't think Randy Carlyle thought it was going to be a controversy or whatever just that quickly into the season. Then right away it was right into, oh, who's your number one? And he kind of brings a bit of it on himself by not naming a number one and by saying they're 1A and 1B. I mean, he doesn't really, you know, help to get rid of those flames.
But can anyone blame him for doing that?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, a lot of teams in this league say, yep, this guy is our number one and we're going to go with him, you know? And if he really proves over a long stretch of time that he can't do it, or, you know, we'll give him a bit of breathing room. You know, a lot of teams do that in the NHL, and that's been a successful strategy. And then there's also been teams that have gone with, you know, two guys who, kind of share the load. I mean, you need the right kind of characters and the right kind of goalies to do that. And, you know, the Leafs have two goalies right now who both want to be number one. So that's kind of the situation that he's in, is that he's got two guys who want to play 60 to 65 games a year, and he doesn't, you know, seem comfortable in giving it to them.
And you also kind of get the feeling that he'd like to say, yeah, Bernie is our guy. We have this definitive number one. Except Reimer's kind of not letting him do that in a way by playing just as well as Bernier when he does get that shot. So it kind of makes it a little harder for Carlisle.
Yeah, Jonathan Bernier got the first 2 starts of the season, and I think we all thought he was kind of like the de facto number one to start the season.
Yeah.
Because he was the reason the Maple Leafs were, you know, sitting in third in their division and looked like a lock to make the playoffs when they went on the West Coast last year before he got hurt. And the season went completely down the toilet.
If he doesn't get hurt, they might have made the playoffs.
It's possible.
Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, they weren't scoring a lot of goals at that time, but I mean, Reimer wasn't, you know, standing on his head.
All the numbers suggested that team was ready to regress because they couldn't sustain the high save percentage that Jonathan Bernier was providing them.
Exactly.
But is Jonathan Bernier that high save percentage guy? Is that the outlier? Because he's never really done it for an entire season. As much as we want to say that this is, you know, And the Kings were holding back this guy who should be a starter somewhere. He's never really done it for a full 82-game season. I don't mean playing 82 games because nobody does that.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't been the number one for a full season, as much as we want to say he was great for half a season last year.
I mean, last year was as close as he got to doing that, right? And then he got hurt, right? He had the hernia thing, and that was something that he was dealing with all year. And the plan was for him to just kind of take a few games off and, you know, rest it up and come back for the playoffs, you know, ready to go. This is something that he had to have off-season surgery on eventually, right?
Yeah.
So it's clearly something that was bothering him in a not significant way. But, you know, it's then he got the knee. when he came back, and then he really had to sit out. And the plan was for him to come back, you know, second or third game of the first round. That was the plan, and he just wasn't able to do it because the Leafs didn't make it. But, I mean, everyone you talk to about Jonathan Bernier says he's fantastic, and that's the thing. He's never had the opportunity to do it. So you can't, it's, you know, it's almost unfair to say, oh, he's never proven he's a number one goalie. Well, he's never got the chance, right? Because he's never had that.
He was behind Jonathan Quick.
Yeah. Yes. He was behind Jonathan Quick, and he came here, and there was kind of, is it him or Reimer? And then when he finally got it, he got hurt. But before he got it, he was lights out. You know, he had a terrific save percentage. He was facing a ridiculous, absurd amount of shots
right.
every night, and he was keeping the Leafs in games.
And that's, you know, that's a really interesting part of this, I think, is when you look at, and I don't think the goalies have any control over this, really, but you look at when they play Bernier versus Reimer, and it's something you kind of mentioned before we started, Arden, is that you kind of get two different teams in front of these guys. I mean, if my shoddy math is correct, I think that Bernier sees an average of like 35 or 38 shots a game, and Reimer gets about 28 shots a game in the games that he plays. So you wonder how that kind of tilts the view.
Bernier sees like a historically high yeah. amount of shots
is
in 60 minutes.
Is there something to that, do you think? Because I know, well, everybody points to Game 7 against the Boston Bruins a couple of years ago, right? Yeah. In that final 12-minute stretch where that team kind of played scared defensively.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Because they maybe weren't that confident in their goaltending. Is there something to this team's style of play changing depending on the goaltender?
There's a lot of rattle in the Leafs. Like, you see that yeah. team, they are rattled a lot of the time.
Although this year, there's been a couple of times where they could have been rattled and weren't.
Yeah. I know, it's early in the year, right? But, like, you know, that Boston game is a perfect example of, like, how in the last 10 minutes of games, this team has, you know, it has generally, you know, showed a tendency to just kind of dump the puck in, sit back on their blue line, and chase guys around the zone. You look at the way Pittsburgh played them earlier this year, and Pittsburgh absolutely just bloodied yeah. them. Like, it was an absolute clinic, and it didn't make sense. These two teams were even in the same league. If you had a good possession team against the Leafs, a good team that can move the puck, and the Leafs will just chase them around all night and tire themselves out.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it a experience thing maybe with these guys? A pretty young core for the most part. Especially when you look at something like that Game 7 situation. Is it nerves? Is it just lack of composure?
I don't know. Coaching, maybe? I mean, yeah. I don't know what you point a finger at, right?
Like, they're always clearly coaching.
These talented guys. Like, Morgan Riley is super talented when you watch him play. Like, this is a guy who will quarterback power plays someday. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the thing that struck me the most when I was reporting this story. And I was there to watch Bernier, but I kept kind of watching Riley because I was like, this is a guy who's like can step up and carry the puck and kind of take control of a situation in a way that other defensemen, you know, can't.
So a 3-3-1 start to the season through 7 games. Mentioned the rough start and, oh man, Leaf sweaters being thrown on the ice, which, I mean, that guy.
Heard it was a Habs guy the second time, wasn't it?
I don't know.
I saw that reported. There was actually a Habs fan who did it just to mess with people.
Really? So yeah. He owned a Leaf jersey, but he ripped it off somebody's back?
He bought it so he could throw it on the ice.
I wish I had that kind of cash to be throwing away a couple $100. But they lose the first 2 games of the season. Montreal, Pittsburgh come back, smoke the Rangers. Henrik Lundqvist was horrible in that game. Win an overtime game, comeback game against the Avs, which they dominated puck possession-wise, fully deserved to win that game in overtime. Lose that first game of the back-to-back against the Red Wings 4-1, where they were thoroughly outplayed, and Reimer wasn't particularly great. Jonathan Bernier was great, though. Yeah. In Detroit, they end up with a point, although it's hard to fault them on that goal with about 10 seconds left in overtime. They lose that game, and then they dominate the Islanders, who were off to a great start as well. So 3-3-1 overall, are there any grand takeaways from this team? Is it as inconsistent a team as you expected?
That's the word I'd use, is inconsistent, because there's some nights, like, they play a team like the Avs, who are quick and, you know, have a, you know like to carry the puck and move the puck. And they played well against the Avs, and they really kind of neutralized a lot of what the Avs were trying to do against them. And then they played against Pittsburgh a few nights earlier, and Pittsburgh was absolutely all over them. And you even look at, like, that Red Wings back-to-back. You know, when they played Detroit here, didn't play particularly well. And then they go to Detroit, and they come away with, you know, an overtime loss that, you know, could have been a win if they could have put the puck in the net. But, you know, Jonathan Bernier, I mean, I've watched a lot of the tape on Jonathan Bernier, and that was as good as I've seen him play in a long, long time. Like, he was absolutely, and he said after the game, he said, I tried to up my compete level, and he did.
Why doesn't he do that every night then?
I don't know.
That's stupid. but, okay, listen, Jonathan Bernier was great in that game, and he's been great more often than not as a Toronto Maple Leaf. But I will say this, and I've said it a couple of times on this very radio station, and you could say the first two games that he started this year, he does allow the odd lousy goal. Even when he was winning those games last year, I recall, you know, the save percentage was still high. It's almost, and I like to make the comparison to like a shortstop who will make the occasional error, but he will make the spectacular play as well.
Right.
And he makes more spectacular plays than he makes errors, but the errors are still there as well and are part of the whole package. You don't necessarily get that as much with James Reimer. I feel like James Reimer is a more steady Eddie guy. And maybe that's just confirmation bias. But yeah. That's what I see. And you mentioned you've seen so much tape on both guys.
Yeah.
Do you see that as well, that Jonathan Bernier will have the occasional lapses where he'll go behind the net and try and play the puck for some reason, cough it up, or allow the lousy goal, which he did in both those games. It may have cost him a point against the Canadiens, allowing that first goal in the first shot of the game as well.
Yeah, he's not a great puck handler, and he never has been. It's something that he's been constantly working on, and it's, you know, he's a guy who will try to rely on his defenseman to handle the puck, and when he has to, it often doesn't go that well. What I see from James Reimer, I mean, Bernier is kind of the polished guy who's been very highly coached throughout his career and has come up with, you know, a lot of proper technique. He's always so square to the puck, like he's always in control and just kind of collected. With Reimer, I see a guy who's kind of scrambling a lot. You know, he's a guy who's kind of unorthodox in that he's not always in control, and he makes saves, and that's always been his thing, is that he's kind of makes these like saves on his back.
It's a good thing to do when you're a goalie, is make saves. Yeah,
absolutely. But you know, I see a guy who's not necessarily as polished. That's the main kind of difference that jumps off the page for me with them. But I mean, with Bernier, like, I don't know, you're talking about a guy whose save percentage is over 920, whose save percentage goes up when the Leafs have a lead and goes up even higher when the game is tied into the 930s. If you look at how, you know, that's kind of broken down. So if you want to take away those, like that, maybe that odd Pacioretty goal that goes under his pad, or that odd puck handling mistake, you're talking about a guy who would be next to perfect.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis along with Dave Zarum and Arden Zwelling. A lot of people talk about score effects, and what you mentioned is kind of interesting there, Arden, about score effects affecting save percentage. Mm-hmm. Is that a thing? And we're still kind of on the cutting edge of hockey analytics. I don't know, are people doing studies on score effects as it pertains to goalies? Because I know it affects, you know, possession, and you have to look at the situation in the game, and sure, you didn't control the puck a whole bunch at the end of the game, but you're up three goals, and that shouldn't really play into the overall evaluation of a team's performance. Can you throw in goalie save percentage into that equation as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of websites out there that you can go to, and you can look at a guy's save percentage when his team's in, when his team's down, when his team's in the lead, and when the game is tied. And so I personally, when I look at it, I kind of logically, I think it's more important to have a better save percentage when your team is up or when your team is tied. When your team is behind, I mean, you're already losing, right? And you're probably going to be facing a lot more pressure generally, because your team's trying to score goals, so you're not going to have defenders back. But when you're up or when you're tied, like, I think that that's actually kind of the time when your team needs you to, you know, kind of shut the door the most.
Yeah, and James Reimer famously was not so great in a situation up three goals.
No, he was not.
A couple of years ago. We mentioned the inconsistency overall of this Maple Leafs team, resulting in a 3-3-1 record. You can talk about Phil Kessel being maybe the most inconsistent guy, but when he's good, man, is he good. He's got 8 points in his 7 games this season, 4 goals, 4 assists. He's only scored and picked up points in 3 of the 7 games, but he has 8 points.
Mm-hmm.
Had a couple of goals and an assist against the Islanders on Long Island, a couple of points against the Avalanche, and 3 points against the Rangers. Is there anything to read into that? Because Phil looked pretty mediocre early, and that first line looked pretty mediocre early in the season. But when they've been good, and they were good against the Islanders, they look great, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, and it was kind of surprising to see them get off to that start, because you would think they'd have this familiarity from playing together last year and whatnot. But with Kessel, I think that's pretty much the deal with him. He's not going to be a guy who just compiles a point in every game or so, anything like that, but he's going to take over games for you.
And he's a streaky guy.
Totally. That's what he brings to the table. He'll win you games, and he'll be absent for others. So I don't think there's any panic or anything like that as far as the Leafs go, because this is what you're expecting out of this guy.
I like Phil, man. I like him a lot because he's crusty. You know what I mean? Because he's got a kind of a mean side to him.
This
is
a shameless plug, but I read Christina Rutherford's story on him in the magazine. I'm a huge fan.
And we played some of her interview with Phil Castle last week. She really is able to open up some of these guys that you didn't think there was much there.
It's a skill.
It's a tremendous skill, really. Yeah, he's an interesting guy, and he's a very polarizing guy.
But he's your best player on this team. He is the most talented player on this team. In that Avalanche game, he went down into the Avs zone, took the puck and scored.
Yeah.
Against, with like two guys standing in front of the net.
That was one of the more spectacular goals already scored this National Hockey League season.
He just went and got it done. Right? He's your most talented player, and when he wants to, he'll go and win games.
And just before that goal, he had another like breakaway like that where it could have turned into a goal like that. I mean, he just creates these plays.
So I like him because he's so unbelievably talented, and he's got these like tremendous like character flaws that are just on display like at all times. You know, like, he's kind of a dick, and I like that about him.
Yeah, and he hates speaking to the media, which I guess we love. Maybe.
So, I respect kinda. That.
I like that. Yeah, I respect that.
I really
that.
Do.
Yeah.
Makes it difficult to do your job occasionally, but yeah.
I'd rather that than the guy
let's put it this way. I could see it from his perspective.
Totally. And I'd rather that than the guy who's just going to spit cliches that I can't use. I can use a guy who's crusty. Yeah. Like, I can make something out of that. But the guy's just spitting the same, like a Dion Phaneuf, it's very hard to write a story around because he's so robotic with the media.
Like another guy like that is Evgeny Malkin, where he just won't be in the locker room by the time the media shows up.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's more you can take away from that than for him to come out and tell you that, both teams played hard.
Yeah, got to give 110%. It's very important. One of the other stories before we move to the rest of the National Hockey League surrounding the Maple Leafs is the young defense corps and Jake Gardner, whether he's in the lineup, whether he's out of the lineup. That was a story for a while. And then them running with seven defensemen and one fewer forward because they're not running that fourth line out there like at all. But Stuart Percy has emerged as a real asset for this team. Should more people be talking about the fact that they have three pretty good young defensemen in Jay Gardner, Morgan Riley, and now Stuart Percy? Are there a lot of teams with that kind of luxury?
Well, and it's kind of funny because they brought in Stefan Robida, they brought in Pulak.
Who's been pretty brutal.
They brought in like
these
veteran dudes, right, to kind of take care of things on the back end. And then you get like a Stuart Percy who came out of nowhere. Like, I don't even think the Leafs expected Stuart Percy to be on this team.
First round pick, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think they expected him to be here this soon, right? And he just showed up to camp and had a tremendous camp and really earned a spot on the team. I mean, the guy, the odd man out, has been Jake Gardner, unfortunately. And it hasn't been clear, really, from the coaches to us, the media, in what Jake Gardner's been doing wrong.
Right.
You assume that they're telling him, but we're not really hearing a clear explanation on that.
Well, and, it was telling to me when Stefan Robida actually did get sat down, when Jake Gardner sat couple of games in a row, and the third game got back in there, and Robida was the odd man out. I was kind of curious to see whether Randy Carlyle would do what seemed obvious to me, but might not have endeared him to his bosses, right? They go out and get this veteran in Robida. He was their big offseason acquisition, not a huge acquisition, but their biggest one that they made, and Randy Carlyle was not afraid to sit him down for a game. Now, it only lasted one game, and then they went with seven defensemen in the game after that. But it was kind of interesting. I mean, that if you were talking to a layman, someone that had watched those games, they would have said, yeah, Robida or Pulak, one of those guys has to come out of the lineup, and that Randy Carlyle actually had the stones to do it was kind of interesting.
It's tough from an optics perspective for him because he's got Robida, who's like the NHL veteran, right? Who's like the guy that, if you sit him, like that's going to be that's going to be a big thing in your locker room, right? Because this is a guy that you're counting on to be a leader and for guys to look to. And then you got Jake Gardner, who's got a contract and who's like the future of your team.
Yeah, so he's locked up till 2019.
You sit him, and that's also bad. Like, that's also bad optics. Like, Randy Carlyle can't really win in the situation. And maybe you sent out Stuart Percy, like that would kind of solve his problems, but Stuart Percy's been playing so well that he can't do that.
The Edmonton Oilers finally have a couple of wins under their belt. And it's never too early to talk about the wheels turning in the NHL trade rumor mill. And there are rumors that Nail Yakupov could be on the trading block and that they'd break up that core of nice young forwards because, man, they can score. That's never been a question with that Edmonton Oilers team. They can score. It's keeping the puck out of their own net. Now, part of that is probably save percentage and getting an a number one caliber goalie. Maybe they think they have that now with Victor Faust and Ben Scrivens, but there's still some question marks. Is it in their best interest to finally break up that young core, or is this the worst thing that could? If you're an Oilers fan, are you freaking out that this could be you're getting 50 cents back on the dollar because you're at a point where the Oilers are maybe at their most desperate? Because, yeah, I don't know if anyone expects them to break into that top eight in the West and actually make the playoffs, but they got to show some kind of improvement or else somebody's gone, whether that's Dallas Eakins or, you know, go down the list there. Are the Oilers finally at a place where they should think about trading one of those young guys, Dave?
You know, I wouldn't be there yet if I was in Edmonton. I wouldn't be ready to move on from the kind of rebuilding process and give up on that yet. I think when you look at what they've been doing, completely starting from scratch with such a young core, young team, that takes years to develop into something. I mean, it's not going to happen quickly, and I could see why there'd be frustration over that to win games and actually put out a product that fans can get behind. But, I mean, you think of, you know, there's so many examples of guys being traded really early in their careers, going somewhere else and turning into something, and there's always regret from the team doing the trading. Just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of, like, Charles Barkley when he went from the 76ers to the Suns, like, early in his career, and then became this, like, all-world player. It's worse.
You have to bring it back to basketball, didn't you?
And Charles Barkley, always.
Yeah.
But it's worse if you're in Edmonton and you see that happen. Like, they trade Yakupov, he develops into what everyone thought or thinks he might still become. That's even more of a gut punch than having to go through another losing season, isn't it?
It certainly seems like it. And things are, I guess, are a little bit on a more of a positive trajectory for the Oilers. They've won three straight, so got to give them their props as well. The Kansas City Royals come away with a win in Game 3 over the San Francisco Giants yesterday. We'll talk about them having a 2-1 lead. Also, Joe Maddon opting out. Did people know he had an opt-out? Why didn't this happen when Andrew Friedman left the Rays? And why did Andrew Friedman say he's coming back with Don Mattingly next year? And why does that actually still appear to be the case? And could Joe Maddon end up in Toronto? That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
We'll answer them all, or at least do our best to do that coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, Dave Zarum, Arden Zwelling on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dan Robson.
It's Patrick Waugh, right? It has to be Patrick Waugh. No, Martin Brodeur, Dominic Hasek. No, Terry Sawchuk, Glenn Hall, Bernie Perron. It's one of the most heated debates in hockey history. Who is the best goalie of all time?
Hooks it in front, two great saves.
Now, hockey stats guru Chris Boyle ends the debate.
Sanders, oh, what a stop! What a save!
The father of the shot quality project at Sportsnet.ca spent hundreds of hours tracking thousands of shots.
Oh, incredible stop!
To create a new way to analyze and grade puck stoppers through the decades. And the top tender is likely not who you think it is. The most important position in the game finally has a definitive way of separating the best from the rest. Or does it? Who makes your top 10? Do you agree? Disagree? And do you have hundreds of hours to crunch the numbers and prove us wrong? It's Patrick Waugh, right? It has to be Patrick Waugh.
No!
Appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Live in the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum and Arden Zwelling from Sportsnet Magazine. World Series now is in control, I guess, if you can call a 2-1 lead in the series being in control. But the Royals do enjoy that lead after a 3-2 win over the Giants yesterday in Game 3. Game 4 goes tonight, 8:07 first pitch on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Vargas against Vogelsong. And yesterday, I mean, both managers pretty much got what they wanted out of their starters. Tim Hudson, 5 2/3, gave up 3 earned runs on 4 hits, 1 walk, 2 strikeouts. Jeremy Guthrie, very similar line for the Royals. 5 innings, 2 earned runs on 4 hits, no walks or strikeouts. But if you're the Kansas City Royals and you're Ned Yost, you sign up for that. Because in comes Kelvin Herrera, Brandon Finnegan, Wade Davis, and Greg Holland, shut in the door for 4 innings. No hits allowed. Couple of walks from Herrera. They were throwing around 100, which is what they do. This has been the formula for success all postseason long for the Royals, and it's resulted in only one loss. And that one couldn't be pinned on the bullpen. Arden, we see bullpens go up and down year after year. One team has a good bullpen one year, and then it's kind of lousy. The next relievers are kind of, you know, look at the Blue Jays.
You see that in Toronto especially.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But look at what the Royals have done with these guys. I mean, it's hard to imagine the trio of Herrera, Davis, and Holland really regressing all that much. It's an incredible weapon they have at the back end of that bullpen.
Absolutely. And you just kind of, you know, with bullpens, it's the thing is you kind of like, you wait. As if you like, if you're a baseball fan, it's into statistics. You like, you think like, all right, eventually it's their numbers got to come up, right? Like, eventually something, they have to do something wrong. It
hasn't happened yet, though.
It hasn't happened yet. And do the, you know, does that happen in what would have been game 8 or 9 of the World Series? And then you know what I mean? Like, that's perfect if you could just play it out that way. Or does that happen in like game 6 or 7, right? Like, when does it eventually fall off? Because I refuse to believe that they're just going to be perfect forever. I cannot buy into that.
Yeah, it seems unlikely. Have your perceptions of this series changed, Dave, when you're looking at, you know, the Giants taking big game James Shields? I hate calling him that. I think we can finally retire that name, even though he gave it to himself. They took him to the woodshed in game 1. Looked like they were just going to continue to ride the momentum that they've enjoyed this postseason. Since then, the Royals battled back after suffering their first loss of the postseason. What's the outlook for them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that the Royals came back. I know the Giants, a lot of people had them favored heading into the series, but I mean, and it even goes back to what Arden's talking about with the bullpen here. I mean, I really do think that there's some kind of team of destiny thing going on with this Royals team. It is a science. I've proven it. And this Royals team falls right into that category. That's why these guys don't get hit. That's why this bullpen doesn't get hit against. That's why like they haven't faltered yet, because there's something special going around this Kansas City team. And I think that's what we've seen the last couple of games. It's the only explanation.
I need a team of destiny stat. That's what I need. Eh?
TOD. That's the next level of advanced metrics. They're being able TOD. To figure that out.
The Royals TOD is in double digits, and that's unprecedented.
Look out.
But honestly, is there something to be learned here? Are there other teams around Major League Baseball looking at what the Kansas City Royals have done with that incredible bullpen?
I do think we might see teams try to kind of emulate that. I mean, always in sports, it's always this kind of copycat thing going on. So maybe you'll see teams go away from making sure they have that one solid closer, that like Trevor Hoffman kind of guy. I don't know why he's the first name that came to my head.
He's a name. Yeah.
And instead go look for pitchers who can go 5-6 innings and then hand it over to a platoon. I think we'll definitely see a lot of teams try to emulate that next season.
They're so volatile, right? I mean, every team tries to build a killer bullpen every year. Like, every team's trying to do it. It's so hard to do because it's so unpredictable.
Well, and there's not many guys out there that throw 101 like Kelvin Herrera has done throughout this postseason. And, you know, the Giants don't have a horrible bullpen by any stretch of the imagination. But it is true, though, that you know, especially here in Toronto, Alex Anthopoulos has kind of shied away from adding bullpen pieces because he's believed that they're a little volatile, right? Like part of that deal, remember with the Cardinals to acquire Colby Rasmus, it was sending some bullpen pieces out. Mark Szczepanski.
That's right. Yeah.
The Cardinals wanted to build their bullpen. That was a big part of the reasoning for sending Colby Rasmus out. The other headed to Toronto. I wonder if the mindset is starting to change as a whole in Major League Baseball, where there's more importance on the bullpens, and is that a correct way to evaluate this?
I think a lot of the time when you get a guy like a Herrera or whoever who throws 100 and has nasty off-speed stuff, you think, well, what? Let's start him, right? Like, let's get five, six, seven innings out of him instead of just one, right? Like, and so you want to see if that holds up. I mean, because Brandon Morrow could be that guy who would come in and throw 100, 101, nasty little slider. Or you could start them, right? And you, it's when do you kind of give up on guys as starters and move them to the bullpen and use them in those situations? And do you have the luxury of even doing that? Or do you have to turn these guys into starters so that you get those innings and get in the position for your bullpen to save you a game, let alone, you know, because you got to get there first for your bullpen to face those situations.
Yeah, and the Royals, you know, this is a team that hit the fewest home runs in the major leagues during the regular season. Didn't hit a home run yesterday, but they have it going on for whatever reason in the postseason. And when you thought that, oh, it would be that one loss that would knock them kind of off their perch, it really hasn't. They've been able to bounce back nicely in the next two games to take this 2-1 series lead into game four tonight in San Francisco. Other news around Major League Baseball, kind of surprising news as well, was Joe Maddon's departure from the Tampa Bay Rays yesterday. Said he was going to opt out of his contract. Doesn't know where he's going to go. Of course, the rumor mill would have suggested that he would end up in L.A. with the Dodgers with his boy, Andrew Friedman, who just took over the reins there. But apparently that's not going to happen because Friedman came out immediately and said Don Mattingly is going to be our manager for next season. And he hasn't backed off that. Now things can change, I guess, and he could fired Don Mattingly in 5 minutes. I don't know. It's possible. But it really does not look like that's where Joe Maddon's headed. There are rumors that maybe the Blue Jays could offer him a big deal to come to Toronto and replace John Gibbons. Although Alex Anthopoulos, again, has come out and said John Gibbons is going to be our manager for next year. Again, this can change. But right now, looks like John Gibbons is going to be the manager in Toronto. Firstly, how great is Joe Maddon? He's good. If you ask most people, though, they say he's the best manager in Major League Baseball. How much impact can a manager have on a team? Is this Blue Jays team any different this year with a different manager? How about that? Is this Blue Jays team maybe in the playoffs, maybe in a wild card game, if they don't have John Gibbons and they have Joe Maddon?
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I am kind of in the camp that the manager position in baseball tends to be a little bit overrated in terms of how these guys impact the game kind of day to day. I think the best managers are the guys who do things like utilize their bullpen the right way, platoon players effectively.
John Gibbons does that, though. But what he doesn't do is he doesn't have voodoo priests come in, right?
Yeah,
like he doesn't do weird stuff. They don't have road trips where they get dressed up. And the Rays didn't make the playoffs either. They were a worse team than the Blue Jays, so it doesn't work all the time. But Joe Maddon does that stuff. And you make fun of it, I guess, when you lose games. But he's done a lot with a team that hadn't been doing a lot until he arrived. So is there something to be said for being that quirky guy who you know, deals well with the players and, you know, has them dress up in different outfits and does that weird stuff? Is there something to be said for that?
I think having a group that likes each other is, means more.
But what comes first?
Yeah, I don't know.
Right? Is there a guy, like, can you like almost play matchmaker as Joe Maddon and get everybody to get along?
I don't know. I mean, does it help that you bring in, like, you know, snakes to the clubhouse or, you know, penguins or whatever he does?
Well, it definitely doesn't hurt.
If you do that stuff, the thing is, they do that in Toronto and PETA freaks out, right?
Like, yeah,
you can't do that stuff, doesn't play here. So I don't know. Does that stuff help? Unless you're in that situation and you're one of those players, you can't really tell. But I mean, I don't know. If they brought some penguins in here, I'd like you guys the same amount that I like you now, you know?
Yeah, I do think that
it's not gonna make me like you anymore.
I do think that well, that's where you and I differed. I do think that with the manager, these kind of things we're talking about in terms of like bringing the clubhouse together and whatnot, I think that's the kind of thing that you can or you would ideally get from your veteran players, you know, as opposed to your manager. And maybe that's where the Blue Jays would need to look instead of at the managerial spot.
That's a good point. Like the players kind of dictate whether, you know, who's getting along in the dynamic of the clubhouse a lot more than manager. A good manager actually stays out of the clubhouse.
I don't know,
because the clubhouse is the player's space.
Yeah, but would you say that about Joe Maddon? When I think of the face of the Tampa Bay Rays over the last five years, I think of Joe Maddon. I don't necessarily think of Evan Longoria or some of their great
David Price.
David Price. I think of Joe Maddon. He has been the face of that franchise as much as a manager can be.
He doesn't swing a bat. You know, he doesn't throw a pitch.
And how much of that is because every media person covering that team is interviewing Joe Maddon every day, and we're hearing from him every day as a result of that. Whereas the other guys, you know, we'll hear from David Price on the days he's starting, maybe, you know, but they're sort of the public face in terms of the media perception. So I think that's why it's easy to think that they have a bigger role from that perspective than they might.
Joe Maddon doesn't exactly shy away from it either.
No,
right?
He's a media whore.
Joe Madden's a pretty big fan of Joe Maddon. Yeah, you know, as great as he is to cover,
with the glasses,
right? Like, and I've covered him a ton, and he's awesome. Like, you love that as especially as a beat guy going down there every day, just like, what awesome nugget am I gonna get today? You know, this just makes my job that much
easier. So he ends up being the central figure of a lot of your stories as a result of that.
Yeah,
but I look at a team like the Indians of a year ago. Mm-hmm. Bring in Terry Francona. Change the fortunes of that franchise entirely. Now, yes, they had good players, okay? That was a big part of it. But late in the season, like, you couldn't beat them. They stormed their way into the playoffs a year ago. And I wonder how much of that is on the manager. And I think there is something to be said. It's not worth, you know, like 10, 20 games in the regular season. But there was, especially here in Toronto, there were moments where you thought maybe it wasn't the most tight-knit group, especially at the non-waiver trade deadline when you had the comments coming out of the clubhouse there, and they didn't have a unified voice.
That was more players towards front office than players toward manager. I mean, nobody was mad at Gibby that they didn't add at the trade deadline. I mean, they're kind of mad at Alex and Paul Buist. And I mean, Gibby, the thing that, like, Gibby gets underrated for the way he kept that clubhouse together while using platoons, while taking starters out in situations. Like, look at what he did, the way he handled Dickey, right? Like, after Dickey was getting blown up in the sixth and seventh every night, he started taking him out earlier. Look at the way he used platoons. I mean, these are things that ego-driven athletes could get really, really upset about. And the fact that he was able to do those things and nobody was, you know, coming out and throwing him under the bus publicly or anything like that, that's kind of undervalued.
So you don't think the Blue Jays should be in on Joe Maddon?
You don't want to scramble. You don't want to look like you're scrambling. Like, you don't want to look, because that's a bad look optically for Joe Maddon to come out onto the market and just immediately go get him, right?
Why is that bad? Okay, would you agree that he's probably the best manager in Major League Baseball? Whether it's overrated? No, you wouldn't. So who's the best manager in Major
League? I don't know who the best manager is in Major League Baseball.
But he's one of them, right? He's on the short list of best managers in Major League Baseball.
I think there's probably 30 guys who all do a reasonably similar job.
So there's nothing to be gained. Anybody, they're all interchangeable pieces then. So you put, I mean, even less than I, emphasis than I put on the manager. You're saying that you can take any manager. You can put Bo Porter in control of this Blue Jays team and they do just as well.
I did not say that.
But you're saying that they're all pretty similar.
I think that the difference is negligible. I think it's I think that optically it looks bad if Joe Maddon hits the market and you just scramble to go get him. It makes you look like, oh, so you had this manager last year that you didn't like that much?
No.
Had this guy for the last 2 years.
No, it looks like you're trying to do things to improve your team.
If he is, if Alex Anthopoulos truly believes that he's the best manager in Major League Baseball, how is that scrambling to go out and get the best manager in Major League Baseball?
If Alex believes that, do you think Alex believes that? I doubt it.
I don't, but...
And if you're Alex, don't you want that in your back pocket, that fire Gibby card in your back pocket, so that, like, if things go south next year, you can play that card.
Get Cito back again, sure.
Right? That's, like, that's what's happening
with
Don Mattingly, right? That's what's happening in L.A. Like, Andrew Friedman wants to keep that card that he can play of firing the manager. Because if you bring in your guy right away and it goes badly, that you don't have that card to play.
Yeah, I don't think Andrew Friedman's worried about, you know, the heat being on him. That team's going to be good no matter what. I mean, they're going to outspend everybody. They've got a great core, and, you know, they were in the playoffs, and their ace got beat in spectacular fashion a couple of times, shockingly.
But, you know, like, the other side of it is, if you're Joe Maddon, do you want to come to Toronto? I mean, you got a lot of options for you. I look at teams like, I don't know, like the Chicago Cubs, you know, they have a lot of young assets. It's a team I think you might really want to go to.
Where'd you hear that one?
I don't know. Yeah. baseball insider. But like, would Toronto be your dream destination if you're Joe Maddon? Is that even possible?
Well, I think you want to go somewhere where you don't have like the lowest payroll in all of Major League Baseball, which I'm sure is probably the big reason why he left the Rays. Now, and you probably want to escape the Yankees and the Red Sox as well, which would make Toronto not that interesting a place for Joe Maddon.
But you'd imagine with his reputation and whatnot, he would have kind of the pick of whatever managerial positions are available.
You would have thought, but how come...
Is he that great, really? I mean, is it the Penguins stuff?
But he is like, a name. He is a name, and it does mean something to fans, especially if you're in like a sad sack situation where you haven't won a long time. It does mean something to fans to bring in a guy who's been there before.
He does pitch. Throw me a pitch, so then.
Okay.
Throw a slider.
No, but you're being far. Run. We're talking about sports fans. You're being far too rational here with your thought process.
Should the Maple Leafs go after Mike Babcock in the offseason? And you can make the comparison. Maybe a hockey coach has more to do with...
A lot more.
You think a lot more?
In terms of systems and the way a team plays line combination, like a lot more with hockey in terms of how your team plays. For baseball, I mean, it's like you know, Monty Burns. Like, hey, Daryl, go hit a home run, right? It's like... Coach. Like, what? How much? Like, in terms of a way a baseball team plays, I mean, the effect a manager has is managing the bullpen and making positional substitutions. You can't really tell a guy, okay, you should really go and catch that grounder and then throw it to first base.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. All right, I'll do that.
And people look at the defensive shifting that the Rays do. That's, I mean, partly Joe Maddon, but that is coming up. That's way above his head. What's filtering down to him. Mm-hmm. And he was a good soldier. I mean, all the reports have, you know, Andrew Friedman in that front office being in on the lineups day to day, giving him information that he could use. So obviously very adept at using those new metrics, and he'll be using them wherever he goes next. Where do you think he does go? We got a couple of minutes.
I think Chicago works. I think the Cubs are actually a good fit for him. I'd imagine he ends up there. If not LA, I mean, LA is the obvious fit. But I mean, I don't know. They got a manager, right? So he'll pick. I think he will be patient and wait for his spot, because it's like you said, he'd served his time in Tampa Bay. He's kind of earned his stripes and paid his dues and all that crap. So I think that he'll like kind of wait for the perfect situation to arise. He's made his money too, so.
Yeah,
he's good,
and he's going to get paid wherever he goes. We are very close to the start of the NBA season from a Raptors perspective as well. On Wednesday, Raps at home against the Atlanta Hawks. They're going to fill the barn naturally because they've been doing that even in the preseason. Was there anything to be learned during the preseason? What are our expectations with LeBron James now in Cleveland and the Raptors stacking up in that Eastern Conference? Maybe the Knicks going to be better? I don't know. Nets probably worse. Bulls definitely better. We'll talk about the Raptors and their prospects coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis with Arden Zwelling and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum and Arden Zwelling. And for the next 20 minutes, we're just going to wind up Dave and let him go. Like a top. Because I know that's what he wants. He just wants to talk about his round ball.
About time.
Come Dave's on, Dave.
Got some inflammatory opinions.
I don't even know if I need to say anything. Basketball, go!
10 players, 4 quarters, 1 court. What about it?
48 minutes or 44? Did you like 44 minutes?
They shortened it, yeah.
They experimented with it. I don't know. I don't think it made a difference.
No?
It's already... I mean, do you want games ending in less than 2 hours? Because I think that preseason game, the 44-minute game ended in like an hour 58.
And how much of that was like the final 5 minutes of game time?
I don't want like history books messed with and records and whatnot.
So yeah.
It changes the format. It changes everything.
Listen, I think they just need to get rid of some timeouts. It's just too many timeouts.
I'm down for that.
Late in games.
Jesus.
There's just
you can't watch it.
And then they added the video review thing. So I just kind of slowed down everything even further.
Right. Yeah, they need to stop having the officials actually looking at the review. Have somebody else, an off-court official.
Get rid of the timeouts. Give them one timeout per game or two max, one per half. You know what I mean? Like, timeouts in general are just wimpy, really. You're saying, I don't want to play the game. I need to stop. You know?
Ban timeouts entirely. You know, from changing on the fly. You should have changing on the fly in basketball.
I think that'd be pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. It's like a pickup game.
I don't know how we ended up on that train of thought, but we did. The Raptors open up their season on Wednesday. Man, October's almost over. Where does the time go?
Soon it will be winter, and there will be snow.
I've wasted my life.
It will be miserable.
They open up their season at home against the Atlanta Hawks. This is a team who I think people rewrite history in what happened with them last year in that, oh, yeah, I mean, it's great moves. Masai Ujiri, what a genius. Yes, those moves were nice, but I don't even think Masai Ujiri thought that they would have turned out the way they did. Maybe it wasn't a full-on tank mode move dealing Rudy Gay, but it wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world to Masai if that's what happened. Instead, they took off like a rocket ship. The pieces he added were key contributors as well. And this team, apparently Rudy Gay was the worst thing for that offense because the balls started moving all over the place. The offense was great. It was a thrilling team to watch, really. Kyle Lowry had a career year, shockingly, in a contract year. Can he replicate that? What are our expectations for this Raptors team, Dave?
Well, you kind of touched on a lot of things there. But yeah, when you look at last year and you look at the team as they're built right now, you can't say that this was Ujiri's intention in putting the team together. When that Rudy Gay trade was kind of, he got back a bunch of expiring contracts, freed up cap space. It had all the kind of signs of a rebuild with his own people kind of in place. He tried to trade Kyle Lowry to the New York Knicks.
Right. Had a deal in place. After.
Yeah, apparently last minute it was vetoed by the Knicks owner, James Dolan. This wasn't the plan. But that being said, something happened. Everyone came together, and to his credit, he saw the product on the court and realized, you know, maybe we can roll with this. And that's kind of what he's done. He re-signed guys like Vasquez and Patrick Patterson, kind of gave the keys to Kyle Lowry full-time with that big extension, and recognized DeMar DeRozan for the kind of budding superstar that I think he is. And as a result, you know, I can't remember the last season with the Raptors when they've come into the season with so much stability from the year before. It seems like every year that it's like a whole new roster. But this year, they're pretty much bringing back the entire team. And it was a team that performed really well. After that Rudy Gay trade, they were the best team in the East. They were better than Miami for the rest of the season there. And that's kind of hard to ignore. So I'm pretty optimistic about them because of that.
Isn't there a danger, though, in getting too enamored with something that worked and maybe was just lightning in a bottle, and you mm-hmm. got numbers that maybe Kyle Lowry will never get to again in his career? It was certainly an outlier so far in his career. Isn't there a danger in you know, overvaluing your own players, Dave?
Yeah, no question. You got to be honest with yourself. But I mean, the way I put it in the magazine in our Raptors issue was, I'm trying to remember the wording, it was like Fleming's discovery of penicillin. They fell ass backwards into a winning formula.
All right.
So that's kind of like how I feel about the Raptors. And look what's happened with penicillin. It's really caught on. So.
I'm allergic, but yeah, I hear it's good.
Okay. But the point is, like, they found something. And yeah, you can overvalue your guys, but it worked. So why would you change that? You know what I mean? Like, what would you have done differently? Would you have not re-signed Lowry? Would you have let him walk to another team? And then you're really screwed. Because you've lost your kind of your leader, for lack of a better way of putting it. They didn't have enough money to make a big splash in the free agent market. They didn't quite have, I don't know if you're ready to kind of trade guys like Valanciunas or Terrence Ross. I think they did exactly what they had to do.
Clearly, these guys just keep trying to lose, because that's what worked last year, was trying to sell his pieces and trying to build a loser. He built a playoff team in the process. So that's clear. Why would you vary? You know, why would you differ from
that? But like, you're kidding, but you're kind of right.
No, I guess, I'm not. No, I'm very much not.
No, but when your expectations are low, it is easier to kind of...
That's another part of it. Yeah. The target is going to be more on the Raptors' back this year, which changes the dynamic going through that Eastern Conference.
It does. So it'll be really interesting to see how they respond to that. But I think this is just it's a good team. You know, they have their boxes checked off in a number of areas. Last year, they were top 10 offensively and defensively. And like I said before, I don't see any signs of that necessarily changing anytime soon, because... The pieces are all there. They They're still there.
Is that top 10 NBA or top 10 Eastern Conference?
Oh, that's NBA.
Is that NBA? Because I've got some buddies.
That's
and
all
I'm
world.
Pretty sure we could take a run at the Eastern Conference. Like, I got like 10 bros that we could probably put together a pretty decent team.
But isn't the East better this year, man?
Okay,
Washington's going to be better. They were good last year, and they got into the second round of the playoffs, knocking off a good Bulls team. The Bulls are going to be better because Derrick Rose is healthy at this second that I'm speaking right now, maybe not tomorrow or a week from tomorrow, but right now he's healthy, and you spread out the talent a little bit between Cleveland and Miami. Is not going to be horrible, are they? Are the Knicks any better?
What's going on
with the East?
No, I think the Knicks are a bit of a mess, although like Carmelo Anthony, he's one of the best players in the league. But another team that you kind of left out there was the Charlotte Hornets.
Yeah.
And bringing in Lance Stephenson, that's a huge signing for them. A real kind of tough guy, brings a lot to that team.
Real tough to blow in some guy's ear. That's really tough.
Yeah.
I love him because he's crazy. He's unhinged.
He's a lunatic. It's perfect, like, X Factor.
He looks not well, like, mentally, and I like it.
And he might not be.
I really like it a lot.
So, yeah, a lot of teams, there's like 6-7 teams that all got better in the offseason. And you know what? The Raptors are one of them, too. I think Lou Williams was a really big pickup for them. I think you're going to see a lot from him this year, playing a big role, especially late in games, if everything goes according to plan. So, yeah, it'll be tougher. But you know, yeah, the expectations, and this kind of speaks to how bad the Raptors have been. Yes, expectations are high, and they seem really high. But even then, like, is anyone saying the Raptors are going to get past the second round? Like, expectations are high because people want to see them back in the playoffs and maybe win a round.
But wouldn't you rate this season as a disappointment if they don't get to the second round of the playoffs?
Yes, but I don't think it's like a crushing loss. I don't know. What's a word slightly less than disappointment? Yes, I write for a living.
I don't know, bummed?
Yeah, they'd be a little bummed.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, last year this ran into a team that was, like, perfectly designed to beat them, right? Like, Brooklyn was just, like, they had everything that took to, like, just
and had a
crush
chance
the
to
Raps
win
spirits.
A game 7.
Yeah.
We're one shot away still, yeah.
I think there was a lot of other teams that the Raptors would have beat in that first round in the East, but, like, the Brooklyn was just, like, that was a nightmare matchup.
Including Washington, probably, because they owned them during the regular season, and they ran through Chicago.
Yeah.
There's a lot of teams, and I think the Nets probably knew that, too, because they set up their final couple of games to match up against the Raptors.
The Raps just got bullied in that series. Like, they just got absolutely...
It was like a classic, like, welcome to the playoffs kind of moment. And historically, a lot of times you see teams, they have to go through that before they succeed, right? You got to get your ass kicked a little bit before you can come back.
Was there anyone on that team who'd been to the playoffs before?
The Raptors team?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did Lowry go with Houston?
No.
So I'm not sure there was anybody on that team who'd even been there before.
Amir Johnson won.
Amir Johnson?
He watched the Pistons win a championship. I think it was his first year out of high school.
He waved the towel real good.
Yeah, and he was really happy to do it. Like, he was 17 years old, I think.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Dave Zarum, Arden Zwelling. I'm Ben Ennis. Raptors open up their season on Wednesday at home against the Atlanta Hawks. They were 7-1 in the preseason. Did that mean anything? Did we learn anything in their preseason, Dave?
No, I don't think you can take anything from the record. I mean, it's cool, you know, good for them, congratulations. But it's just preseason. Their teams are experimenting with players. They're just trying to get guys into game shape, and that's kind of. And Casey even said it last night. I think after the Knicks game in Montreal, preseason is just a way to get guys into game shape. So I don't take too much away from that.
Did you see anything in like how the Raptors are going to play though? Like, are they going to run those like the two point guards, like, is Vasquez and Lowry?
That a couple of times late in the season.
Definitely another because it works so well for them. I think, you know, there's a lot of advanced stats that show that Vasquez was their best crunch time player last year when he was playing alongside Lowry with DeRozan moved to the three. What we did see in the preseason with the Raptors is sometimes they went out with that three guard lineup. I don't want to say three point guard because I think Lou Williams is really more of a shooting guard, just an undersized shooting guard, but having Lowry, Vasquez, and Williams on the floor all at the same time. And that's something that...
But then who sits? Like, who's not playing? Is Terrence Ross not playing at that point?
Yeah, it all becomes situational. Yeah, Ross was the odd man out
but
there.
Is he not one of your biggest threats, you know?
Yeah, and he's a guy also who's only getting better, and you want to see him play a ton of minutes just to develop his game. But, you know, DeRozan's an interesting guy because he can play, Casey alluded to it, can play spot minutes as a power forward even.
Yeah.
Because he has the height and he is stronger than he looks.
You put DeRozan at power forward.
Against matches, because a lot of teams now, they go small, right? I mean, I don't think it's going to work, but what they're doing in Phoenix, where they signed Isaiah Thomas, who's like a 5'11 point guard, and they're going to play him alongside two other point guards, and that might be their starting lineup. it's I don't want to say it's a trend, but it's something teams are willing to experiment with that more and more. And you're not going to do it for like 20 minutes in a game, but to do it for between timeouts or, you know, five minutes here or there.
But if you're playing against that, are you not happy to just put in a big lineup if you're defending that? Put in like a couple bigs.
But you can exploit them.
Let the you know give a couple perimeter defenders and let them take their shots.
Isn't
and
that,
aren't you happy to let them take those shots instead of getting in and getting to the foul line?
Well, isn't that one of the greatest strengths of this team is that they can go small with, you mentioned, the guards, and they've got a couple of big trees there in Valanciunas and Amir Johnson that on occasion can look like two of top 20 big men in the NBA as well.
And they have good depth in the front court, too. Tyler Hansbrough is always an interesting guy when he hits the floor.
Not going to score, but...
No, but he brings you something that I think you need, that kind
he's
of
gonna
like, intimidation
stir up
factor.
He's
going to stir it up. Yeah, exactly. Patrick Patterson, too, is a pretty versatile guy for that position. So Casey's got it's a luxury. He's got like a full chess set that he's got to play with this year.
One of the interesting things I thought about this team going through, you know, what they did into the playoffs, latter stages of the regular season as well, was trying to figure out what they do in crunch time, in close games, last shot opportunities. And at first it was DeMar DeRozan getting those shots, and it didn't work out. Whole bunch. Dribbled off his foot in Portland. There were a bunch of times where it just did not work out. Isolation for DeMar DeRozan, because I think we all agree DeMar DeRozan's a great player, but maybe doesn't have the handle of some of those crunch time guys, and it's unfair to compare him to LeBron James, but guys of that ilk. Kyle Lowry started getting those touches late game and got it in the most crucial moment of last season, dying seconds of game 7. Now his shot was blocked. I guess he's your de facto crunch time guy again this year, Dave?
I think so, yeah. And even with the DeRozan thing, I mean, I think as somebody said about getting those reps, you know, like not everyone's going to come in and hit those game winners right away. Not everyone's Damian Lillard, who comes in from day one and is the most clutch scorer for his team as a rookie or a second year player. You know, DeRozan looks at things like that, like the turnover off his foot, and then goes in the offseason and addresses that. So we've already seen in preseason and even in spots with USA that his ball handling seems to have improved a lot. But that being said, yeah, I do think you look to Lowry as that kind of go-to guy. But it's still something that I think is in flux. Lou Williams showed in the preseason that he's a guy who's willing to take that shot and makes it quite often. So I think it might be like a who's the hot hand and kind of give it to that person.
Does Dwayne Casey want to eventually hand this over to DeMar DeRozan? In his perfect world, is DeMar DeRozan that guy that gets the last shot and not Kyle Lowry? Would he want him to be the clutch guy, and he'll do everything he can to put him in that position? Not unlike Randy Carlisle probably wants Jonathan Bernier to be his number one starter. He's going to do everything and give him every opportunity to lose that job. Is that what Dwayne Casey's probably going to do with DeMar DeRozan?
Well, you know, I think he's got a lot of confidence in Kyle Lowry in terms of kind of the leadership and just the willingness to kind of put it on the line, however you want to say it. With DeRozan, what you like about him being in that position is that he can get to the free throw line like few others. You know, he's one of the best in the league at that. And that's a huge asset in those late game situations, to be able to stop the clock and get those free throws, which he nails at a really high rate. And that's kind of a thing with Lowry, too. So they're really similar in the way that they approach that late game situation. So it will be interesting to see who he decides to go with. I'd imagine for now, Lowry's the guy just a little more comfort, I don't know, a little more safe.
Yeah. Last year, the Raptors finished third in the Eastern Conference, of course, matching up with Brooklyn, who finished sixth behind Miami and Indiana. Eastern Conference is going to look a whole lot different this year. Cleveland is not going to finish on the outside of the playoffs looking in, unless something crazy happens, like LeBron getting hurt or something.
Even then,
they might still be okay. Where do we see this Raptors team?
The Raptors, I think we're going to see them back at third, you know, maybe fourth. I think they're right there in terms of the pecking order. They're not going to be a team like Chicago, who I think is the best team in the East. I really like what they did in the offseason. They're not going to be Cleveland with all their talent. You know, I think a lot of people are forgetting how good Kevin Love is as part of that equation. That's why I say even if LeBron goes out, this is still a pretty good team. But then you got teams like the Raptors, the Wizards, the Hornets, who are all in that same, maybe even the Heat, you know, it depends on how healthy Wade is. And if Chris Bosh can get his groove back, like Stella did. But I think they're just right in that conversation, that upper middle of the pack where we saw them last year.
is that acceptable? Is that good? I mean, the whole point of this thing is to win an NBA title, and nobody has any illusions that this team is a title contender this year. So where does that leave them? I guess everybody will look at that free agent class that will probably include Kevin Durant, who's out for a while here, and the Raptors being big players for Kevin Durant, and who knows what the landscape of the salary cap is in the NBA at that point. But are you just going to try and have a slow build until you can add a guy like a Kevin Durant to get over that hump and be that NBA title contender? Or is it possible that you can build a team without a super superstar like that Pistons teams, you know, who just limited everybody to, you know, 80 points a game. And I don't think the Raptors are that team. Can you win a title building a team this way?
Well, I don't know if you could win a title, but I wouldn't. When you look at the way like the fans responded to the playoff run last year, I don't think you'd want to put them in a position where they'd have to go back to following a losing team just because you want to kind of bottom out free cap space, compile draft picks and assets so you can go out and get a guy like Kevin Durant. I do think for the Raptors, it's like a matter of like incremental steps forward. You have this core, they're young, they're playing really well together. See what you have there. See what a year or two of this brings you. I mean, you think of a teams like Houston, like the Rockets, who geared up their whole offseason to get Melo or maybe LeBron or one of these guys, and they got nobody. You know, they got Trevor Ariza, and they're much worse off for it. And you think the Raptors, they don't have a guy like James Harden. You know, DeRozan's close, but he's not in that category. They don't have a guy like Dwight Howard. So
right, how do you get one of those guys? Don't you need
draft
one?
You draft them.
Well, and how are you ever going to draft that high if you're always?
But if you're the Raptors, you might have collective parts that add up to that. And for all you know, Kyle Lowry, what we saw last year is the Kyle Lowry we're about to see. I mean, it's such a question mark. But if he keeps developing like that, then he can be one of those guys. DeRozan, who knows what he can be? He just finished an All-Star campaign, a great player with Team USA. Maybe he can become one of those guys. Valanciunas is still young. He might be able to become one of these cornerstones big men.
Bruno
is going to be he's going to be a Hall of Famer, obviously. So, I mean,
Dynamite drop in.
No, it's a good point. But the point is, you don't know what you have, but you know you have something, and I wouldn't give up on that quite yet.
Aren't they kind of making it up as they go along a bit, though? Because, like, Kyle Lowry's not even supposed to be on this team, and now they're, like, locking him up long term.
Yeah, well, because, you know, things didn't go according to plan, but you have to call audibles. You have to go with the flow or however you want to put it, and that's kind of what they've done.
Where did you, I know you did the NBA preview for the magazine. Mm-hmm. Where did you have the Heat?
Sixth, I believe.
Yeah.
Sixth or seventh.
Is it possible that, you know, they're a top four team, though? You know, now that Chris Bosh is being handed the car keys, they're not going to be horrible, are they?
No, I think they're going to be pretty decent. I mean, it's really tough because, first of all, Dwayne Wade, a lot of people are forgetting that he's one of the best, maybe like the top three shooting guards of all time.
Health is a factor for him, though, right?
And health is a factor for him. But if he goes back to being kind of the number one guy, if he can play 70 games a year, 65 games this season, he's still might have something left in him. If he does, that's a really good team. If he doesn't, then it's all on Bosch. And Bosch, who knows what the hell is going to happen with Chris Bosch, because he went from being the guy in Toronto in every possible way to being, you know, an afterthought in Miami. And he even said, like, when you hear him in interviews over the past few seasons, I mean, he sounds like a different person, less confident and whatnot.
Yeah.
So to just say, like, okay, Chris Bosch, go back into being the guy, it's probably not that easy. And if he's not able to do it, then, yeah, that team's going to struggle. But I think there's enough talent there for them to be a playoff team, certainly.
The Raptors should have gone out and gotten Chris Bosch this offseason.
It would have been interesting,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Even his LeBron moment in Toronto.
But again, but he got a huge contract. Like, he's going to be getting like close to $20 million a year. And I don't know if you'd want to pay.
And is that your superstar that gets you over the hump?
Yeah,
probably
exactly.
Not.
Yeah. The interesting one with the Raptors is Vince Carter.
Go get Vince.
Yeah.
We were saying that the
other
day.
Were we talking about that?
In the office. Yeah, it was me. Yeah. They should have brought in Vince. Let Bruno go play overseas. Let him get like play actual minutes instead of sitting on the end of your bench.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think D-League, something overseas, play him. He needs to be on the court.
Absolutely. Play him and then bring in Vince.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Bruno's.
You know how many friggin' jerseys you'd sell?
It would have been fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, you rewrite history a little bit there, too.
But I think people are already over.
I don't know if they should be.
Interesting.
That's a topic for another,
another
day.
He's a changed man. He's a different man, you know?
Yeah, he's a pretty good complimentary piece in Dallas there.
He fit in really well. I think he's going to be really integral in Memphis as well this year. That's kind of something they needed off the bench.
Well, speaking of Memphis, we'll have a look at the Western Conference a little bit, and the Lakers, who will now go the entire season without Steve Nash, looks like his career is finally done. The nerve issue in the back continues to flare up, and it's a season-ending scenario for him. He hasn't come out and said that he's retiring, but all indications point to that being the case. We'll look back at the career of Steve Nash and maybe look a little bit at the Western Conference, how things stack up in the NBA. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum, Arden Zwelling on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine, here's Dave Zarum.
We knew we were dealing with a scrappy young team that was going to play at the end of the buzzer, and I think it showed in one game in particular where we were up 20 going into the fourth quarter, and we end up being in a dogfight at the end of the game with this group.
It's been a long time since you heard opponents say that when describing the Toronto Raptors. That was Lou Williams, the newest Raptor, talking about what it was like to face Toronto last season. Yes, a lot has changed in Raptor land in the last 12 months. After their best season in years, Canada's team has gone from irrelevant in the NBA landscape to important, feared even. And they've done it off the strength of their backcourt. Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, Gravis Vasquez, three players who have dictated their success on the same terms as the franchise by demanding respect from a league that wasn't prepared to give it to them. Factor in the addition of Williams, another guy with a chip on his shoulder, and the Raptors' biggest strength got, well, a whole lot stronger.
The story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on next issue and in the Apple newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, along with Dave Zarum, Arden Zwelling. Steve Nash looks like his career is done. And if you watched any of those ESPN digital shorts with Steve Nash last year, pretty interesting in him understanding his athletic mortality and that he was on the back stretch of it. I guess that's kind of obvious when you're 40 years old.
Getting started.
Yeah, you're just... I guess, and you know, I think for a lot of people, the most interesting part of that was, yeah, I'm kind of hanging on for the money. And who among us wouldn't?
Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him for saying that.
Yeah.
Love it.
Did not get any flack. I'm sure there are guys that would get flack for saying that.
He got a bit of heat, didn't he?
Did he?
I thought so. Dave might know better. No? Were people backing him? Are we that?
I think he was refreshingly honest.
I know, but like, didn't he catch some grief for that?
I don't think so, because how can you really argue with that when you think about it?
Right. Yeah, I mean, who wants to go through the rehab and the physical stuff that comes along with getting your back in shape?
He's not a team player, damn it. He's selfish.
Yeah, Steve Nash.
He's not a team player.
Second or third all-time in assists.
No, selfish. Just selfish guy.
Selfish. There's such a thing as selfish assists. I don't think we think Steve Nash did that, though. So he's done, probably. Greatest basketball player from this country ever. And we were talking about this before we came on the air, how things might have been different, not just for him in his career and how things played out, but for the Raptors and that franchise's history, if Brian Colangelo was able to pull off that massive signing and bring Steve Nash to Toronto. Now, it's a different space-time continuum, so maybe Steve Nash didn't even get hurt. Maybe he's still playing, and the Raptors have won an NBA title.
It's funny because people were so bummed when that didn't happen. They're so upset, and now look at what you would have gotten from him, because now we can look back and see what he is, assuming, like you said, assuming that he still gets hurt. That would have been a disaster for the Raptors franchise. And now you've got a playoff team. It shows that when like teams make moves, you shouldn't get too excited or too upset about them.
It's another, I don't know what it is with this franchise, but whenever they screw up, they succeed, right?
Yeah.
Last year, they tried to tank. They succeeded. They tried to get Steve Nash. Couldn't. That worked out for the best. What's going on? Do they have the reverse hex, I guess? I don't know what's going on with that, Dave. Explain it to us.
No, it's...
We'll sit back and listen.
Okay, you nailed it. It's a reverse hex. No, obviously things worked out for the better. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of sports is you never know until they actually go out and play the games and blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. I think, you know, obviously there's excitement for Nash coming because of what he meant for basketball in this country, and just to see him in a jersey with a maple leaf on it.
He wouldn't have been in the jersey, though. He would have been in the trainer's room all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing with that.
Yeah.
Why hasn't Steve Nash come out and just say, it's over, I am retiring? Well, what is he waiting for? What is there a possibility that he does come back one more kick of the can at 41? Like, that's not happening, is it?
Maybe.
I think, like, it's almost like when you're a guy like that who's so, despite the injuries, is so kind of regimented about keeping in shape and that kind of thing, at some point you're almost like maniacal about it and you're not willing to come out and say it's over, you know, kind of holding on to that last grasp of something. And I think that's kind of what's going on with Nash. He's going to get healthy and then reevaluate from there, whether it's realistic or not, who knows. But I mean, for these guys who are athletes at that level, I mean, how long has he been doing this for? It's hard to just kind of like face reality.
When he played recently, like in the few games that he's played, he wasn't like a joke out there. Like, he was still able to run the floor.
He played limited minutes. He played around 20 minutes, I think, last season in the games he played. I think he appeared in 15 games or 10 games. And he was a different guy, but granted, most of his time on the court was recovering from an injury, so it's hard to evaluate him in terms of like versus the rest of his career. But yeah, he's not like done. And the other thing is, he has skills that age well. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like shooting ability,
vision,
yeah. Shot selection. These are things that age well.
Yeah, but running the court, yeah, that didn't exactly allow him to age that gracefully.
Well, then you go 2-point guards, right? You get somebody, you know, a young kid to run the ball, and then you get Steve Nash to kind of, you know, quarterback it a bit and, you know, hand him the ball top of the key.
I think the harder thing for a guy when you get to that age in the NBA is, imagine Steve Nash trying to guard Russell Westbrook, something like that, like the amount of physical toll that would take to kind of contain these 6'4" super freak athletes. Like, that's where you're at your element.
And we all understand Steve Nash was never the greatest defender. More of a turnstile, really, than anything on the defensive end.
So take that, add back injuries and years.
What if we, when evaluating Steve Nash's career, I think we can all agree those Suns teams were exhilarating to watch. And if not for some pretty, I think, unfair suspensions, maybe we're talking about that team in a different light. And they maybe beat the Spurs. They didn't. Never made an NBA final, did Steve Nash. Is that a knock on the resume? I mean, it's a team game, but he never made it there. And maybe that team gave him the best opportunity to.
If he stayed with Dirk in Dallas, maybe that would have been his shot to go to the finals, right? Like, if he hadn't, he left, right? But so if he stayed there, because they were just starting to become something.
Yeah.
I think Dirk was just becoming Dirk.
Cuban didn't want to pay.
It was like the extra $4 million or something like that. Cuban didn't want to do it. And I agree that that team was onto something. That Michael Finley was like a fun part of it. They had all these cool pieces.
Well, and they did win a title. They won one.
Yeah.
And they ended up winning one.
Steve Nash would have been there.
With a lot of different pieces. But yeah, that would have been, I think that team with Nash would have won a title at some point. Agreed.
And they appeared in two, right? They lost to the Heat, and then they beat the Heat, in the first incarnation of the big three, where they made it to a final.
Mm-hmm.
But he never won an NBA title, didn't even appear in an NBA finals. How do we evaluate his career? Obviously the greatest basketball player this country has ever produced, and we talk a lot about the influx of Canadian young basketball players like Andrew Wiggins and Anthony Bennett. That's all, you know, due to Vince Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be pointing more to Steve Nash? How come people don't talk about the impact that Steve Nash winning, you know, a couple of MVP awards and being this country's most obvious face of basketball? How come we don't talk about his impact on the young basketball players in this country?
He was also underappreciated in Canada, Steve Nash was. He saw a lot more press for Vince Carter, who was an American who came and played great here. But, you know, Steve Nash is winning MVPs, and it was a story. But you didn't get that kids looking up to him and that adoration or whatever. He wasn't as celebrated here as, you know, kind of Raptors stars were. When I was a kid, I had way more of a recognition of, like, Tracy McGrady and Morris Peterson and Vince Carter than I did of Steve Nash when I was growing up.
But Steve Nash is, you know, far superior players to any of those guys.
I don't disagree.
And they were great players, but we're talking about, you know, one of the all-time greats, not just of this country, but in the history of this game, with the assist totals, the free throw percentage. I think it's the greatest all-time in NBA history. Free throw made percentage belongs to Steve Nash. That's a good question. Is he underappreciated in this country? Should we, I mean, is there, Should there be a statue of Steve Nash somewhere? I don't know if there is in Victoria somewhere, but there definitely should be in Victoria.
There probably will be, too. I mean, I never got the feeling that nobody was realizing how important Steve Nash was to growing the game here. I mean, he seems like he's been right at the top of that list for me, certainly for a long time. I think Vince Carter had that kind of star power, maybe if you want to put it that way, that Nash didn't coming like as they were coming up through like the early 2000s. But I think what you saw was Vince Carter helped popularize the NBA, certainly in Toronto and in Canada. And as that grew popular, Steve Nash became more on the radar, and everyone realized, oh, we have a guy of our own who's doing even better than this Vince guy. And then everyone kind of turned their attentions there once the game had grown, if that makes sense.
It's a shame that he never got to play in this country and never got to play in his home province in BC. Grizzlies obviously moved on.
But you know, I don't know. You can watch all his games. You can still catch all his games. I mean, it's a little feel good if he plays for Canadian team, but I don't think it makes you appreciate him any less. It doesn't make him any less fun to watch. It doesn't make his accomplishments any worse.
But I think it is cool that LeBron James gets to go back to Cleveland, and I think that adds to the
Rose
story.
Derrick Rose in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you live in the city, like, you want to watch your team, right? Like, you want to watch, if you grew up in Toronto, you wanted to watch the Leafs. You weren't necessarily following Wayne Gretzky when he was in LA. Mm-hmm. You were following Doug Gilmore, you know, and Dave Andrychuk. Like, you were watching those Leafs teams, and you were cheering for the Leafs when they played the Kings in the conference finals. I mean, those were the guys that kind of resonated with you more so than, like, your countrymen who were doing really well for other teams. It was when you grow up, you get the team first. I think when you're a kid, you get, that's what you recognize and resonate with first is the team. That's what you associate yourself with, not so much that a guy from your hometown is doing really well somewhere.
What does the future hold for Steve Nash, in your opinion?
Surgery.
Well, surgery, definitely surgery, and maybe some ice cream when he gets out of surgery. That'll be good. And we know he still holds that position as GM of the Canadian national team.
Yeah.
Is that a full-time job for him? Do we see him in a front office of an NBA team at some point? And is that NBA team here in Toronto? Do you think there is going to be some sort of affiliation of the Raptors to Steve Nash?
I don't know. I mean, I think they'd certainly maybe take a shot at bringing him on in some kind of capacity. But he's one of these guys, you know, there's so many guys who they don't know anything but basketball or whatever the sport is. He's one of these guys who's got he's got a lot of interest spread out in a number of areas. Like, I think he's got a production company in Hollywood. He's active in, like, the soccer community. He's basically got a lot going on. So I think he's going to be in a position when he retires where he's not going to be kind of lost in the wilderness. He's going to know exactly what he wants to do, and he's going to have a lot of options in front of him.
Is he the man to lead this Canadian renaissance on the national stage? Because I know we keep hearing about it. Oh, you know, Andrew Wiggins, Anthony Bennett, these guys, they're all going to play for the national team, and this is going to be one of the powerhouses in international basketball for years to come. And I'm not discounting that. But so far, we haven't seen it. They didn't qualify for the World Cup of Basketball. Those guys didn't play in the qualifiers for it. Steve Nash added some credibility, his name being attached to it. But so far, he hasn't been able to get those guys on board to play in any meaningful games.
Well,
are we putting the cart before the horse here, already anointing Canada as the next great, great international powerhouse?
Well, I don't know how many people are saying they're going to be the next great power.
I just did on the radio.
But I do think that they're going to be relevant, which is something that you haven't been able to say before.
Right.
There's a difference there.
But they haven't even been relevant yet under Steve Nash.
No, because they haven't played together. I mean, this summer was their first opportunity to have guys like Wiggins and Bennett, Tristan Thompson, all those guys together on one team for Canada. They've practiced together. They never played together in competition. But this summer, those guys were getting kind of doing the draft thing and getting ready for the first season. And it wasn't... That tournament they were in wasn't really playing for anything necessarily. So I wouldn't fault them fault Nash as a GM for not bringing them together this summer, because I don't think that was ever realistic. But it kind of goes back in terms of Nash's role with the team. It goes back to what we were talking about with managers and baseball. I mean, how much impact would he really have on the team's success, considering the player pool? Yes, it's bigger than it's ever been, but it's still pretty straightforward who we think should be on the roster and who shouldn't.
His name add credibility, and if there was any doubt that Andrew Wiggins would play for this Canadian team, the fact that Steve Nash is running the thing, and it's Steve Nash picking up the phone and calling Andrew Wiggins and saying, hey, listen, buddy, we really need you. I know now you've gotten a chance to get your feet wet in the NBA, but now it's time to come play for your country. Doesn't that add an element to the to this?
On paper, maybe, but I don't know where you get the perception from that Wiggins needs to be talked into playing for Canada and really needs to be persuaded by a guy like
because
Nash.
Everybody's needed to be talked into playing for this national team, right? It's just never happened. None of the big names have ever played. Jamal McGlure, didn't play for this team.
But the guys coming up now, they're not. They're not Samuel Dalembert, you know. They're all really, really proud Canadians growing up here, wanting to play for their country. So I don't think anyone's being forced into it. I think this is something that these guys are all growing up playing together, thinking, "Hey, one day we're going to do this on an international stage in the Olympics." You know, they've done it at the junior level, and that's the other thing is that these guys have all played for Canada at every age group coming up till now, looking at that senior team, saying, "That's where I want to be." So I don't think. This has been a goal for these guys the whole time. I don't think anyone is shying away from that.
I don't know.
Talk about it openly.
I'd like to think that you're right. I feel like international basketball does not have the appeal that, you know, international hockey, it's not even a question. The greatest hockey players in this country are going to play for the Canadian national team if called upon for any tournament. Even the World Championships. Well, not everybody plays in the World Championships, but the World Cup.
But the Olympics is different. I think there is something about playing in the Olympics, regardless of the sport. That's something that everyone, as an athlete, that's on your radar. That means something to everybody.
As long as you don't break your leg on the stanchion.
I was just going to say, yeah, to play devil's advocate, the landscape might change when you see stuff like that happening with the Paul George injury. It is another risk for guys. But so is going to the gym every day.
I just want to go to the Olympics. I just want that experience of being part of that event. Being on Tinder in the Olympic Village, like you want, like the experience.
Hold on,
you personally want to?
I don't think you have any hope of being on this Canadian basketball team. But you want to cover it and then participate in the Tinder.
If you're an NBA player, you're like a walking Tinder. I don't really know. I don't know if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
I do. I know exactly.
You don't need any technical enhancements.
You don't need an app to help you.
But I think you just want that experience of being part of that, right? So that's what, you know, that more so than even like the playing of the games. It's just being at that, you know, being at that stage.
It's something you tell your kids about and all that kind of.
Yeah,
and hopefully
the kids might come from the.
Yeah. tell them when they were conceived.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I saw the straight line from Tinder directly to that. Yes, absolutely. We got a couple of minutes before we got to go. Want to touch on the NFL. A little bit here in a couple of big storylines. Well, on Thursday, Peyton Manning just continues to rack up the touchdown passes after passing Brett Favre for the all-time mark last week against the 49ers in a game that was never a game. Three more touchdown passes against the Chargers in a 35-21 win. The Broncos now 6-1, and it almost doesn't matter, right? Like, it doesn't matter what Peyton Manning does in the regular season. His legacy and the success or failure of this team all comes down to the playoffs and the winning of a Super Bowl. And if it doesn't happen, won't this season be deemed a failure for him?
Yeah, I think so, especially at this point in his career. That's what he's here for, is to add another Super Bowl. We saw how he fell short last year, and now that must be a motivation heading into this season. And that's kind of, like you said, when you're defining his legacy, that's what it comes down to at this point. Is he going to get another ring?
I guess he doesn't know how to do anything else other than just be a professional quarterback. If he wasn't a quarterback,
he definitely doesn't know how to act, act surprised or like he didn't know that keep away thing was going to happen, because that was horrible. That was as contrived and ugly.
But, you know, I will say this. He knows few things outside of quarterbacking, because when he was on Saturday Night Live, he was one of the funniest. He was one of the funniest athletes they've had on there for a while.
That was pretty good.
That United Way ad.
It really changed my perception of him.
Yeah,
exactly. And there's a locker room skit with Will Forte too. That was really funny.
Yeah.
There you go.
Before we go, Cowboys also 6-1. They've got that Washington football team at home on Monday. Is the NFL more fun when the Cowboys are good? I tend to think so, but I guess part of that might be nostalgia, that I think back to the Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith days when I see the Cowboys at 6-1. It seems more fun when they're good. It's, I guess, fun in some respect to make fun of them when they're bad, but I don't make like the Yankee connection. I don't think baseball is more fun when the Yankees are good, but for some reason I think the NFL is a little more fun when the Cowboys are good.
I think that this team right now, just because there's so many interesting characters, right? With like from Romo to, you know, Dez Bryant, like freaking out, like just because there's so much, they're just kind of an interesting team in terms of, you know, a character study. So I think that's why it's kind of fun to watch them succeed, but it'd also be fun to watch them fail. I mean, either way, really.
That's what I was going to say, because they're so polarizing. Yeah. You either want them, it's either fun when they're really good or really bad, and when they're in the middle ground, that's when indifference.
If they were just meh, like that wouldn't be very fun.
And the last couple of years they've been meh, 8-8, so it certainly looks like they're not going to be meh this year.
I know you were this closet Cowboys fan.
No,
you knew the record right off the bat.
Definitely not. I just,
who's their back,
I'm with you. I like Romo, man.
Who's their backup right guard?
That'll do it for Sportsnet Magazine Live. Thanks, gents. Dave Zurum. Arden Zwelling. I'm Ben Ennis. An edition of Sportsnet Today coming up next. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.